When somebody asks you to name your favorite song, is it tough to come up with an answer? How about if they narrow the field to your favorite love song? That probably doesn't make it much easier. So many of our songs are songs of love. I mean, think about it. Darling, You Send Me, I Want to Hold Your Hand, My Funny Valentine, Love Stinks. We've got love songs for just about every mood and every stage of the relationship. And today's guest explored the origins. Ted Gioia's book is called Love Songs, The Hidden History. Ted Gioia, G-I-O-I-A, is a music historian, Daily Beast columnist, and the author of 9 books on music. His focus on the music of everyday life amounts to a trilogy now. Love Songs is preceded by Work Songs and Healing Songs. Ted Gioia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Is there a particular approach and rhythm to the earlier 2 books that is repeated here in Love Songs?
Well, they all came out of a decision I made more than 20 years ago. I decided that there was a story about music that no one was telling. Everybody focuses on the celebrities. They focus on what happens in Carnegie Hall or the people in the recording studios and the big superstars. But I wanted to explore the music of everyday life because music changes our life. Music is a force of transformation. It's a force of enchantment. And for most of history, we didn't look to superstars to sing. Everybody sang. Music was part of our communities, part of our daily life, part of our family life. And so I wanted to write the history of music as it related to ordinary, everyday people. So I did 3 books. One was called Work Songs. It looked at the role of music in everyday work. One was called Healing Songs, the role of music in health and welfare. And then finally, I took the biggest subject of all, love songs, the role of music in our romance, courtship, because after all, that's most of music since the beginning of time. It's been about love.
Ted, this has to be a fantastically hard project, I mean, given how long we've had music as humans and the lack of recordings for most of that time.
Well, I almost gave up on the project. I started, as I say, back in 1991, I began taking notes.
Wow.
On a history of love songs. And at certain points, I said, you know, this is just too big of a subject. But I persisted, and I gained momentum by the many surprising things I started to learn, because I soon found out that almost everything I thought I knew about the love song was wrong. The history book needed to be written because a story needed to be told.
So what was the first correction then? What was the first thing you assumed that you realized you assumed in error?
Well, I started seeing again and again at different phases of history, love songs would be involved in these extraordinary social controversies, sometimes battles and bloodshed. And I kept on asking myself, why is this lovey-dovey music so violent? Why does it inspire such strong feelings and controversies? And I only gradually realized that throughout most of history, the love song has been a force for the expansion of personal autonomy, for the expansion of civil rights, human rights, civil liberties. We don't normally think of love songs in that way, but that's what I found in my research. Whenever a new kind of love song comes out, it's generally by people wanting to have more control over their life. It's generally the young people. They want to have control over how they love, how they date, how they court. And they're always facing obstacles from parents, from churches, from authority figures, from lawmakers. And so I found, much to my surprise, that the music I thought was soft and lovey-dovey and romantic was actually a music of controversy, battles, and bloodshed.
So the idea of singing love songs in rock and roll, the rock and roll was what went against the establishment, but the love songs themselves sound like they've been challenging the establishment for centuries.
Well, that's right. We've seen this in our own lifetime. We've seen when new ways of singing about love come out, they are controversial. We forget about it eventually. We now think of rock and roll as part of the music of our everyday life. But when that first appeared, it was extraordinarily controversial. They only wanted to show Elvis from the waist up on the Ed Sullivan Show. When the Rolling Stones went on the Ed Sullivan Show, they could not sing the song Let's Spend the Night Together.
Let's spend some time together.
That's right. Yeah. Mick Jagger was forced to change the words. What I found in my research is that this has happened again and again throughout history. It happened in ancient China. It happened in ancient Greece. It happened in ancient Rome. During the Middle Ages, for 1,000 years, the church virtually prohibited love songs. There are no love songs in the vernacular languages that survive until the 11th century. So it's just an extraordinary history of battles on every front when these songs come out.
And in fact, one of the quotes of the book is that this is the toughest and most battle-hardened mode of artistic expression, the love song. It's been through a real gauntlet over the years.
That's right. And the funny thing was, is when I was researching this book, People would say, well, Ted, what's your next book going to be on? I said, well, I'm going to write about love songs. And they would give me this smug, smirky smile as if, oh, what a silly subject. I mean, they wouldn't actually insult me, but it was sort of borderline there that I was taking a very soft, sentimental subject. And the irony was, is the history of this music is the exact opposite. If you really want to understand censorship, prohibition, battles for artistic freedom, battles for personal freedom, there's no better subject to study than the songs of romance.
I wanted to slap myself a few times yesterday. I was just reading this because Donny Osmond's Puppy Love kept going through my head. But I think actually it is a fair representation of the way that the establishment tended to look at people who sang songs of love, that it was a silly sort of juvenile thing.
Well, they have tried in many ways to control the love songs over the centuries. Sometimes they've tried to make them innocuous and very soft and sentimental. I could go back, for example, to the year 1900, when most American songs were boring. We had these parlor songs, and they were just full of shallow sentiments. And if you'd asked somebody in 1900 where the future of popular music was coming from, they would have pointed to Europe. They'd say, go to the cabarets of Paris and Berlin. That's where the exciting music is. But finally, in the United States, with things like blues and jazz, once again, you had this influx from an outsider group that came and would revitalize the music. And so that's the whole history of the music, is people try to put controls on it, but then from some unexpected place, a new sound, a new way of singing about love emerges and changes all the rules.
Love keeps erupting from us and keeps erupting from us in song. The book is called Love Songs, The Hidden History. Ted Gioia wrote it. He's our guest. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange, and take your phone calls and emails of interest on the exchange at 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the program with Ted Gioia and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the music historian Ted Gioia, G-I-O-I-A. His book is Love Songs, The Hidden History, in which he really goes way back in time to talk about the genesis of love songs and points out that they have been through a lot. You know, to paraphrase the Beastie Boys, we've had to fight for our right to sing love songs over the years. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about love songs and their history. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. So, Ted, you follow some good leaders here. I mean, Darwin wrote of music and love songs, and what did he say?
Well, if you're interested in the love song, you do have to go back to Darwin, because Darwin said all music was a love song. Darwin thought that the reason we sing was to propagate the species. And he spent a lot of time focusing on bird songs. You know, Darwin thought that if you could study what birds did with their mating practices, you could unlock the mysteries of human music. And I've got to say that for a long time, I was very skeptical of this. In my earliest drafts of my book, I pointed out all the flaws in Darwin's thinking. You know, for one thing, he almost never talked about any animal that was similar to a human being. He wouldn't talk about gorillas or chimpanzees, and for good reasons. They don't make much music. And so I thought it was very unconvincing that Darwin thought that we were all like singing birds. But you know what? In the last few years, all this new evidence has come out, all this evidence on hormones and body chemistry and neuroscience, and they've shown the same hormones that are connected to singing are also connected to mating activity and sexual preference and sexual activity. So I've gradually come to accept Darwin might be right. In fact, maybe all songs are a kind of courtship, are a kind of mating ritual.
Is it possible he didn't write about other primates because it was just too dangerous to talk about something that was essentially related closely to us?
Well, you know, he almost says nothing in The Origins of Species about any of this. But when he gets to The Descent of Man, he does start talking about closer species. He was bolder there, but even there, he almost never talked about four times as much space is devoted to talking about bird music as all other kinds of music put together. Now, I've talked to folks and done research on the singing of chimps and apes, gorillas, and I can assure you that when they mate, if you have the dubious privilege of listening to them fornicate, you will not hear much music. So this is a gap in Darwin's logic. But still, there's so much scientific evidence now that indicates that survival of the fittest is at least to some extent survival of the most musical. And if you doubt that, just read the biographies of these rock stars and count up the number of girlfriends they have. That will convince you right then and there that there's some connection there.
And they're not very good looking like Mick Jagger, but let's not go there.
That's a subject for a different day.
Right. So is there a chance then, Ted, that our tree-climbing, tail-bearing ancestors hooted mating calls to each other?
Well, there's good evidence that music had that kind of role in early society. You do have these love songs, too, and they're universal. So there's a question I always ask myself is, if there isn't a biological basis for all this, why do you find love songs in every culture? In fact, you find these romantic notions in almost every culture, too. So it suggests that this music is hardwired into our DNA at some very deep level.
And so, back to the earliest civilizations in Mesopotamia, there was evidence there of love songs?
Well, that's where you get really good evidence for Darwin's theory, because there were love songs. The oldest love songs come out of Mesopotamia. This is more than 4,000 years ago. But they're all about sex. They're entirely about sex. It's embedded in something known as the sacred marriage ritual. This was a fertility rite. The idea was these songs were about sex, but they helped the crops grow. They helped preserve stability in the kingdom. And as part of this ritual, the king needed to have sex with a goddess. And the high priestess stood in. It's hard to get a date with a goddess, you know.
So right.
They had to find a substitute. And the high priestess would step in, and she would sing these songs. Now, it's interesting. Some scholars look at these and say, well, you can't call these love songs. It's all about just getting it on. It's just all about sex. To which I reply, well, look at Miley Cyrus. It's really changed. You know, in an odd sort of way, we've just come full circle. Even today, we're back to the songs that are very similar to those fertility ritual songs from 4,000 years ago.
They're pretty raw and explicit, and right down to the body parts.
That's right. You couldn't put them on the radio. Actually, this is funny. It would be a song from ancient Mesopotamia, but you couldn't put it on the radio nowadays. And that's saying something, given what is on the airwaves most days.
Ted Joy is our guest in the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Love Songs, The Hidden History. There's a name you bring up in here, Enheduanna. Is that, am I pronouncing it correctly, from Mesopotamia?
That's right. That was the high priestess of ancient Mesopotamia. And so on a regular basis, it probably happened once a year, the king would come to her temple, and they would have sex, and there would be these songs. And now there's dispute among the scholars. Did they really have sex? Maybe this was just all talk. It was all talk and no action. But if you go and look at the lyrics to the song, which I do provide in uncensored detail in my book, it's hard to believe that there wasn't something intimate going on in the course of their little tete-a-tete.
Well, so now you move on to the Sumerians and the Egyptians, and it raises the question about how such songs were used. I mean, you gave the context just here in Mesopotamia, but as time went on, was it for public consumption? Was it something people sang in small groups to each other? I mean, so it sounds like it was widely accepted at first, perhaps, or in some of the ancient societies, but then became less so, I guess, as we became less sexualized and more... Oh, I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
More romantic,
up.
You find this in Egypt. We finally find in these Egyptian ruins, these archaeological digs, these love songs that are very similar to the romantic songs you hear nowadays. They're very heartfelt. I mean, these are less about sex now. It's more about missing the beloved. It's interesting. These don't come from the famous leaders. These come from the workers. We find these in these artisan villages. These were the workers who helped build the pyramids. These were probably songs they sang for themselves. But very soon, love songs took on added dimension. Other people want to hear these songs. And so you have this strange contradiction. This music is the most personal expression of my own intimate feelings, but at a certain point, it gets put on stage. And that's what happens in Greece and Rome. And obviously, in the current day, we have this... You know, there's a contradiction we still have out there. When Sam Smith got the Grammy Award a few days back, he got up there, and I loved what he said. He said, I want to thank the person who broke my heart because I wrote this song about her and I got four Grammys. And so this is the same contradiction. It's the music of our most intimate moments, but it's also put out on the stage. And that happened at a very early point in the evolution of this music.
So we've always expressed ourselves with the things we had to say, but there's another additional dimension here, which is we're talking about love songs, not just love poems. Given the lack of musical transcription from Mesopotamia, et cetera, I mean, how much do we know beyond the words about what the songs actually sounded like?
Well, people try to recreate them, and they make their best efforts. I've spent a fair amount of research trying to figure out what these things sound like. And the scholars can't even agree on themselves that when they say that the balog was the instrument that was being played, some people will tell you the balog was a drum. Other people will tell you it's a string instrument. So, I mean, the scholars are full of differences and arguments there. But what we do know is almost from the start, this music was sung. We tend to think of it now as literary text. We look at, for example, the most famous creator of love songs in the ancient world was a woman named Sappho from the island of Lesbos. And it's from that island we get the name of lesbian, because she was a prominent lesbian in addition to being a poet. And people talk about her as a poet, but in fact she was a singer-songwriter. She was like Joni Mitchell, you know? She was out there. She's like Carly Simon. You know, she's singing about love. And nowadays we treat these folks as though they're establishment figures in the literary tradition. But at every juncture, this music was sung and was intended for performance in that way.
Well, now that we talked about Sappho and Anhedonia and some of the other women, I mean, was it generally something that started with women? At some point, did it shift genders and men became the primary creators of love songs?
This was probably the biggest surprise I had in researching this book, is how important women were to the invention of new ways of singing about love. It seemed at every juncture, when some new way of singing about love came out, it was the women that created it. But usually the guys got the credit. And I could give you a number of examples. You know, Confucius is attributed as the collector of the Shi Jing, the Book of Ancient Chinese Songs. But the songs are clearly from a women's perspective, so why is Confucius getting credit for it? Or here's an example that would be well-known to most of your listeners. In the Bible, the Song of Songs, that's attributed to King Solomon. But once again, you read it, it's a woman's song about love. So why is he getting the credit for it? But the biggest example is the troubadours of the medieval period. These are considered the inventor of the modern love song. In the 11th century, these nobles in the south of France started singing about love in an exciting new way. They talked about being in slavery to the loved, to being in servitude to the woman that they adored. Well, they actually took all this from these female singing slaves of the Islamic world, who are written completely out of the history books, completely unacknowledged. But they invented this new way of singing about love. And they sang about being slaves to love because they were actual slaves. They were actually in servitude. But once again, they don't get credit for it. It's the nobles, it's the men of the south of France who get all the credit. So this is a recurring story in the history of the love songs. Women are the inventors. Men are what I would call the disseminators.
Huh. The oppressed people do the work, and the people who are oppressing them take the credit for it.
That's true. And it's also the slaves have had an enormous impact on the history of the love song, and it's almost completely ignored in the music history books. So these were the reasons why, as I got into my research, I got more and more excited about it, because it was a story. I had a new way of framing the whole narrative of Western music. That wasn't what I expected to find when I embarked upon this research, but by the time I was done, I said, you know, I'm challenging a lot of the conventional wisdom of music history for thousands of years. This is, you know, I'm going to shake things up. So it was an exciting process for me to be part of this.
The research resulted in the book Love Songs, The Hidden History. Ted Gioia, G-I-O-I-A, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can visit with us. Give us your thoughts about love songs through history and maybe love songs that you've enjoyed through time and the ways in which they might have changed your life. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. That works anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to Confucius. You mentioned him briefly. He shares a chapter with Sappho. The Shi Jing, I mean, it's this book of songs from ancient China, but it seems like Confucius is almost cast as like the Song of the Year judge creating the Shi Jing.
He was like the Simon Cowell of ancient China. This is an unusual interlude in music history. At some point, the authorities in ancient China decide they want to collect the folk songs of the people. And so this is like a tax. They're going to tax every community has to come up with their songs.
The tribute is paid in song, not in
That's
money.
That's right. And so they're collected in this little collection, the Book of Songs, the Xi Jing. And by tradition, Confucius is considered the person who picked what were the... He's like Simon Cowell. He's the judge out there picking which are the songs that are going to make it into this collection. And once again, you would think that this is a very simple, innocent endeavor, love songs. What could be more innocent than that? But hundreds and hundreds of years of controversy ensue from this simple little collection of love songs. And a whole body of research comes out of later Confucian scholars, and they are determined to prove that these songs aren't really about love. They're really about how to run a political state or a guide to management, or they have a million reasons why these songs can't be about love. And that is, once again, a recurring theme in the history of the music. These love songs actually do challenge authorities, and so they have to try to prove that they're not really love songs.
And so is that the greatest evidence that you provide, that the Xi Jing contained a lot of songs about love because it was suppressed by later rulers?
Well, you look at the debate among the Confucian scholars, which is they're saying if you take these songs at their surface level, which sometimes talk about sexual desire, about kinds of love that would be considered transgressive, we can't allow this. We can't allow this in our community. Some people say, well, you can allow it. Confucius included these so we would have bad examples to avoid. But you run into the same thing a short while later. You know, you go to the medieval era. I'm trying to write about love songs during the medieval period in Europe, and I can't find any. They've been all burned. But you know they're there. You know why we know they're there? Because the priests are constantly condemning them. We have all these sermons condemning the love songs. We have these statements from church councils, from the Pope himself, from Charlemagne. They're all complaining about these love songs. We know they existed. And here's the interesting thing. They're always mentioning women. It's always these women are coming up with these love songs. They've got to stop it. You know, we've got to excommunicate the women who sing these songs. So you find it's the same thing you saw in China. You see it here in the medieval period. It's a recurring theme. These songs come out, and they frighten the leaders, so they need to do something about it.
We're talking to Ted Gioia about his book, Love Songs, The Hidden History, on the Jefferson Exchange. As I read some of the quotations of ancient love songs, and some not so ancient, but you know, certainly from well before our time, and I see what you write about the reactions that earlier discoverers had to this. I wonder if it's necessary to revisit these ancient texts from generation to generation, because the sensibilities or prudity of the time seem to affect how they're interpreted.
Well, we do need to do that. I like to go back to the original texts. And there's always this, there's several weapons that rulers use to control the love song. First, they try to prohibit it. Or they try to reinterpret it. Sometimes they try to change the words. And we saw that in modern times. Pat Boone would take these love songs from rock and roll, take out the dirty words, put in some clean words, and get them on AM radio. So, this formula still exists. And it's interesting to look at the range of options. And there was a period at the time of Dante where the church tried to take over the love song and make it about spiritual love. So, there are these range of strategies. But here's the interesting thing. They never succeed. In the end, the love song always triumphs. These new ways of singing about love are eventually embraced, and they eventually become respectable. Like nowadays, a rock and roller can go to the White House. So mm-hmm. You go from these people being outsiders, they become respectable. Everything becomes respectable that once was ostracized.
You skipped ahead to medieval Europe, but even before that, it sounds like in ancient Rome there was a certain level of establishment looking down on love songs. Was it generally this idea that love in the romantic sense was low and vulgar and, you know, rutting for animals or something?
Well, you know, the Romans were very nervous about love. They were very nervous about romance. In fact, C.S. Lewis would say that the Romans had no concept of romance, but I think he was wrong. I think the Romans understood romance. They were afraid of it because it took away a man's dignity. It made him do unpredictable things. It was like a disease. No one would ever willingly want to fall in love, because once you fell in love, you were vulnerable. You were susceptible to all these curses and bad things that could happen to you. And this is reflected in their love songs in a variety of ways. First of all, there are a bunch of love songs that make fun of love. Mm-hmm. These are love songs that are full of ridicule. They're in the Roman comedies. They're in other satirical sources. But over and above that, the Romans would look down upon singers. It was considered shameful to be a musical performer. We know about that because of that story about Nero fiddling while Rome burned.
Mm-hmm.
The story itself is not entirely accurate, but it is accurate in showing us how the Romans were embarrassed and ashamed of music, and especially love songs. I think to a certain degree we've inherited that today. I know when I talk to people about love songs, even today people are a little ashamed of admitting that they listen to these sentimental songs. So in some degree, the Romans still shape our attitude towards love and the music about it.
You had a couple lines in there about rock critics and the way that they tend to criticize the other songs. They focus their attention on the non-love songs when the love songs are like 90% of the catalog.
Well, that's right. There's a music critic said this. I thought it was very astute. He said 90% of the music out there is about love, but we as music critics, we prefer to talk about the other 10% because, you know, we're ashamed of this romantic aspect in our music.
Isn't that funny? It still gives us the hives. Love Songs, The Hidden History is Ted Gioia's book. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Ted Gioia, music historian, Daily Beast columnist, and the author of 9 books on music. The latest is called Love Songs, The Hidden History, about the fact that love songs have really taken a beating through the years of civilization. Always there, but not always approved of. And in fact, our ancestors way, way, way back tended to look about as approvingly on love songs as our grandparents did on Elvis's pelvis. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the history of love songs. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Ted, given that societies tended to take a dim view of the official society, the establishment, I should say, took a dim view of love songs at various times, did you find any sort of a regular repeating cycle that, you know, love songs would be out of favor for, I don't know, half a century or 2 centuries or something and then come back in or anything along those lines?
Well, you have this continual revolution where the music gets quiet, there isn't a lot of change. The songs of love become respectable, and then there's always this new outburst. And usually, in fact, almost always, it comes from an outsider. It's never the people in the heart of the society. It's never the opinion leaders that create these innovations. It's always a slave, a bohemian, a woman from the working class. You know, we've seen this several times in our lifetime. When there was new ways of singing about love, where did it come from? Well, it was these lads from Liverpool. Or it was hip-hoppers in the inner city, or it's punk rockers, or even earlier, it's these blues singers from the African-American community. So this thing that we've seen over the last 100 years was true 200 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. It's always somebody outside the community comes up with a new way of singing about love, and it shakes up the whole process, which repeats again and again and again.
So repression followed often by outbursts, and not necessarily, as you point out, from within, where you get a response to something. And when it comes back to mind, because if you're talking at the beginning about how boring American music of 1900 was, when I think about the Victorian times, I think about it might have produced things like jazz and blues because, you know, people have been suffering under this repression for so long. And as you point out, too, slavery produced its own music.
Well, that's right. If you look at the connection between love songs and slavery, well, first of all, I told you that the Egyptian love songs came from these communities of the artisans that were working on the pyramids. So once again, it's the lower class there. Then you get into Rome, and in Rome, the performers were almost always slaves. If you went to a Roman comedy, there would be a love song on stage, and it would be slave musicians performing and singing it. Generally, the actors themselves often weren't allowed to sing the songs. So the Romans associated love songs with slavery. Now look in the United States. Look in the heart of the slave period in the United States. We're in the middle of the 19th century. The biggest selling American song is a love song. It's called O Susanna. Stephen Foster. But it's a minstrel song where he is imitating the songs of slaves. So even in the United States, in the midst of our culture, you have the most popular love song of its day is an imitation of slave culture. I'll note that it sold far and away more than any other song of its era. And then if you get 50 years later, 70 years later, it is the sons of slaves, the daughters of slaves. It's Bessie Smith, it's Louis Armstrong, it's Fats Waller who are inventing a new way of singing about love. So we have 2,000-plus years of history that shows, for some strange repeating reason, innovations in love songs come out of the disenfranchised, and some from people that are actually enslaved.
Let's take a call. We have Jim in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ted Gioia, the author of Love Songs, The Hidden History.
Yeah, a little history about love songs. Women and most maternal love songs, lullabies to children. If you go back in history, women could only express love through lullabies to their children. And some of the words, Native American, Hebrew, Yiddish, it's pretty evident that what they're doing, they're expressing themselves through these songs to their children, their very young children, that they could not do any other way.
All right. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. Thoughts on that, Ted?
That is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. The story of the lullaby would make for a fascinating book in its own right. It's a subject I've researched, and it comes again and again into the history of the love song. Here's a very fascinating fact. If you go into the medieval period, almost no lullabies survive. Now, are we to assume that women did not sing to their children? No, of course we know that happened on a daily basis throughout society. But the music was not preserved, nor were the love songs often sung by these same women. And there's a third kind of song from that period. These are the three L's. There's the lullaby, the love song, and the lament. Often the lament over someone who died. And these are forms of music that are associated historically with women. Women were the innovators. They were the propagators. But very little of the music was preserved. So there's a real need for people, you know, what I'm doing. I'm trying to go into the history and take these lullabies, the love songs, the laments, the contributions of these folks, and show how important they were to our communities, to our family life, for our everyday life.
You just mentioned the medieval period, now how hard things were then for the singers of love songs. And I have to believe the church was a major part of this. You mentioned priests that would condemn the songs. Ultimately, did the church end up giving in the sense of co-opting what the pagan rituals around them were, in the way that, for example, we kind of took over somebody else's festival and turned it into Christmas?
Well, that's right. You know, Valentine's Day was also originally a pagan festival, and then it became a festival of St. Valentine. And so we find this, that at a certain point, the church finds they can't stop the love song. And this happened when the nobility of France started singing love songs. You know, when it's just a peasant singing a love song, you can forbid it. In fact, there were these books called penitentials, and they gave guides to priests hearing confessions. And one of the things these books would do would tell the priest, what kind of penance do you assign for different levels of sin? I mean, obviously someone who commits a murder has to do more penance than someone who just commits a robbery. And three of these penitentials mention the singing of love songs as a sin that cannot be forgiven. You have to be excommunicated from the church if you sing these songs. So that tells you how vigorous the church was in trying to repress these. But then in the 11th century, the nobility starts singing love songs. And the church has to make a decision. What do they do? And then they get this brilliant idea. Well, if we can't stop it, maybe we can take it over. And so they get this idea of creating the religious love song, the spiritual love song. The greatest example of this is Dante. Dante, people know about Dante's Inferno. He's writing about Inferno, Purgatory, Paradise. But he's also including the story of his own love life in there, of his relationship with Beatrice, this woman he fell in love with. And so the love song is embedded in theology. And, you know, half a world away in the Islamic world, Rumi was doing the exact same thing, the poet Rumi, the most famous poet of his day in his part of the world. So you had this 100-year period where religious authorities tried to take over the love song, but they couldn't do it. The music was just too sexy, it was too sensual, it was too erotic, it was too romantic. But the fact that they tried to do this is one of the most remarkable chapters in the history of Western and Eastern music, for that matter.
Yeah, along about the time of the book that I was wondering, gee, what were some of the penalties that people paid for singing or creating love songs? Then I turned the page and we got into Peter Abelard. Oh, boy, that's a penalty. Who was he and what'd he do?
The most famous lover of the medieval days were Abelard and Heloise. And Abelard was a famous theologian and philosopher and preacher. And was famous. I mean, people would come from thousands of miles away to hear him talk. And Heloise was perhaps the most brilliant woman of her day. She was skilled in ancient Latin and Greek, and she was a student of Abelard's, and they had an affair. And this became very celebrated at the time. And Abelard wrote these love songs. And interestingly enough, not a single one of these songs has survived.
Not one, really?
Not one. And thousands of words of his writing have survived, but none of the love songs. And this is what he's most famous for now, as a lover. But this tells you about how much the authorities didn't like this. Assailants were hired to attack him at night, and they castrated him. So Abelard, this was the price. Abelard paid the ultimate, well, not the ultimate, almost the ultimate price, for being so daring as to sing these love songs to Heloise. And so it was a huge scandal of its day, and it's still an important juncture in history, but it tells us a lot about how romantic love and the music behind it was viewed during a period of what seems like stability and expanding human rights.
It was viewed as dangerous to the state, I guess. Let's take a call. We have Brad in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ted Gioia. His book is about love songs.
Yeah, thank you. So interesting. I'm going to get this book and look at it. I've wondered often, anthropologists put guesses on when we started using fire, when we made the wheel, and so forth. But they don't guess as to when we started using music. They find some very old flutes and things like that that go very way, way back. But I'm wondering whether, because our brains are structured like they are, along with some other creatures like dolphins and parrots, to have like a music center, is it part of our being human is being able to respond to and participate in music associated to our language abilities. That's my first thing I'd like him to comment on. And the second is a notion I picked up out of the book Sex at Dawn, The Prehistory of Modern Sexuality,
right, yeah,
where he talks about the unusualness of humans in regards of our sexuality being two-sided. One, we're far more sexual than the other animals. The other animals are tied to the smells and the monthly cycle or maybe the yearly cycle, whereas humans do it all the time. And we have an inordinate interest, and there's more specifics I can get into I won't go into. But the other half of that is we're the only animals that are ashamed of it. We hide in the bushes. The other animals don't seem to do that. So I'm wondering whether that phenomenon of inordinate interest and susceptibility to shame doesn't play into this banning of love songs that he's talking about.
Oh, all good points. Thanks for those, Brad. Appreciate it. Ted, your thoughts?
Those are great observations, and I am in complete agreement with them. You do find this paradox in music, particularly if you look at the love song, is you have on the one side this biological element. And the more I studied, the more I was convinced that it is there. It's hardwired into our DNA to have both the drive to create music, which, as your caller mentioned, goes back even before humans. Neanderthals had these bone flutes. And also, obviously, the drive to propagate, to procreate, to keep the species going. But then you have this other aspect that's always involved in music, and also to some extent in sexualities, which is we're creative about it. We're looking for new positions, for new ways of doing it. And that's even obviously more true when you get into music, which is clearly an aesthetic and artistic phenomenon. So this is the teeter-totter. This is the constant back and forth between the biological imperative and the creative artistic aspect of it. And I think it's the meeting point between those two that I find most fascinating, because you can never reduce this all to biology. You can't say, well, Frank Sinatra sings this song, or Billie Holiday, or the Beatles, because of DNA. There's always this creative spark that's inexplicable, but it's driven by our most basic needs as human creatures.
We have another call here from Sharon and Ashton. It might take exception to some of what you said. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ted Gioia. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I didn't hear all of the beginning, and I'm sure that the earlier parts on love songs are lovely, but that whole last bit on Abelard and Heloise was completely inaccurate. I've been studying them for years in Latin, and I have worked on the letters, worked on the Paraclete, everything. And the whole thing about Abelard being castrated because he wrote love songs, about the love songs being lost, none of that is true.
The love songs do exist, you're saying?
Well, no, what she's trying to point out is Abelard got castrated because he was having an affair with a woman. So she's looking
he got castrated by Heloise's relatives because he got her pregnant and he was in loco parentis.
All right. Well, let's take it from there. So obviously we've got a disagreement on some of the facts here.
I accept what she's... I mean, there's a complex history where Abelard was expected to come out and publicly claim that this woman was his wife. He seemed to be hesitating to do this. He was attacked and assaulted. So they're very, obviously, they're very particular, specific issues in the biographies of these people. And I'm not going to dispute with your caller on this. She's right. But what I'm trying to do is put it in context. It can't be coincidence that none of these love songs survived. It can't be coincidence that Abelard later denounced them himself. It can't be coincidence that even as thousands and thousands of words of Abelard's text survived, the love songs were left out. So I'm putting this in a broader cultural context that I don't think is at all at odds with your caller, but she has some specific biographical things that I think she wants to call attention to.
You mentioned the troubadour tradition. Just before we go, have they really established the bones of the general way that the love song is approached to this day?
Well, we still are fascinated by the troubadours, and particularly by this concept of theirs known as courtly love. And the idea of courtly love is that you pay courtship to the beloved. And it's full of ritual. It's full of respect. To many people, this is still the epitome of romance. And I think there's a certain nostalgia in our days of hookups and one-night stands and friends with benefits, looking back to this era in which romance was so embedded in ritual and this romantic vision of the world. So, yeah, they invented a vision of love that still haunts us today.
It really is a fascinating book. I don't know how you managed to jam it all in under 300 pages. It's called Love Songs, The Hidden History. Ted Gioia, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for inviting me on the show.
All right, take care.